When Dick Gregory went to college at Southern Illinois, he was known throughout the town of Carbondale as a star athlete. He later became known around the country as a star comedian, then as a presidential candidate. Now when we read about Dick Gregory, it's usually for his activism in political and social causes. He's been on numerous fasts to call attention to issues. He's currently on the 10th day of a fast in solidarity with Sonia Johnson and other women who are fasting in support of the ERA. The women are fasting until the ERA has passed or until the deadline for ratification has passed. Dick Gregory's longest fast has been 70 days, and during that fast he was monitored by physicians who were trying to understand how it was that he could fast so long without suffering the consequences that other people who fasted that long have faced. Gregory is in Philadelphia to speak tonight at the Harrison Auditorium in the University Museum at 33rd and Spruce Streets. There will be two shows at 8 and 10. Also on the bill will be Black Sheep, which is a reggae band. And before we meet Dick Gregory, I'd like to play for you a selection from an album of one of his club dates. And after we hear this, we'll talk to him about what he's recently been doing. So this is Dick Gregory on record.
I really had a strange trip. So I meant on the plane. I stayed up late last night because I was had a lot of paperwork I had to do, but knowing I had to make this trip here, I didn't mind it too much because I knew I could get me some sleep on the plane. So dig it, I get on the plane and rush to my seat, sit down, and there's a white cat sitting next to me. So naturally, I check him out. Let me say this to you. I always haven't had to check out white folks. This is something new happened about 10 months ago in Chicago. One night, walking downtown in the Loop, up on the sidewalk, minding my own business, whistling a little tune. I dig it, there's a white cat walking toward me. Well, he see me coming, and he jump all the way off the sidewalk and get in the gutter, right? I dig it. As I approached him, very nervously, he said, Mister, you're not going to bother me. You're not going to hurt me, are you, mister? I said, no, boy. So then I told him who I was. I said, I'm Dick Gregory, dedicated and committed to nonviolence. Oh, that kind of eased his nerves. Yeah, he said, you mean you are the Mr. Dick Gregory? I said, that's right, my man. He said, you mean, mister, you don't carry no gun or no knife? I said, no, gun or no knife. He said, mister, you mean you don't do no shooting or cutting? I said, no, shooting or cutting. He said, you mean you really dedicated to nonviolence, boy? I said, yes, sir. He jumped up out of that gutter and said, well, stick him up, nigga. Ever since that day, I've been checking out white folks. You know, I really don't understand, but I travel all over the country and I make a lot of speeches. And wherever I go, the press is always there to interview me. And it's very interesting because eventually, before the interview is over, because of where I am, they always end up asking the same question. Ms. Gregory, why would you say there was no violence in the black community last summer? Now, how the hell I know? I can't say that because then they say I'm militant. So I got to ask them, whether I know it or not.
Mr. Nominator, Miss Gregory, why would you say there was no violence in the black community last summer? And without batting an eye, like I really knew, I said, well, there was no violence in the black community last summer because all of the black leaders was in Ireland serving as technical advisors. Now, they doing their thing over there. Boy, them Catholics and them Protestants been fighting one. They fight one of 6 days a week. Then on Sunday, they go on church to pray over it. And you know, in all honesty, it really makes no difference who's riding or where the rides are being held. All cops react the same way to ride. You know, the Irish Catholics and Protestants be battling one another, and the Irish police blamed it on outside agitators. Billy Graham and the Pope. I don't know, have you ever just stopped to think about how many religious hassles is going on in the world today? You ever thought about that? The Catholics and the Protestants is fighting one another. The Arabs and the Jews is fighting one another. Sometimes it kind of makes you wonder what great secrets the atheists have that makes them act so godlike. So if all the right-wingers in Ireland is blaming all the problem on Irish extremists, like H. Rapp O'Brien, Eldridge McCleaver. You know, I don't know if we have any Irish Catholics in the house this evening, but in case there's a few among us that have some loved ones in jolly old Ireland, and you're planning on getting in touch with them anytime soon, tell them, Brother Greg said if they really want to overcome and have a smashing victory against the Protestants, they got to start acting more like black folks. Tell them they got to quit all that damn looting and burning. Pull itself up by the bootstraps. Tell them, go on out and get them some jobs. Little work ain't never hurt nobody. And the most important thing, you got to tell them, they got to learn how to be patient. They're moving too fast.
Well, that was Dick Gregory from one of his club acts recorded on record. Dick Gregory is in the studio with me now. He'll be speaking tonight at the Harrison Auditorium in the University Museum at 8 and at 10 o'clock. And also on the bill will be the reggae band Black Sheep. Dick Gregory, when was the last time you heard that? I don't know if you own your albums or have ever listened to them.
First time I heard it since I cut it.
No kidding.
I don't know. I guess that's back in what, way back before 70, I guess.
What were you thinking as you listened back to it?
How funny it was.
Oh, good.
And how timely. And how timely. Uh-huh. You know, it's just, it was very interesting.
Do you still think of yourself as a comedian?
Oh, yes. I'm very funny.
Yeah. Do you think comedy is a good consciousness raiser?
No.
Mm-mm. How come?
Well, not professional comedy. If you, as a person, would look back over the most hilarious thing you've ever had, it didn't come from a professional comedian. It come from someone at home or something that happened or something real silly where you just get the biggest yacht going. That can raise your conscience. That can make you bad. As a professional comic, all you do is pay your rent. You go out. Music comes closer to if you fail right now and fractured your knee, there's not a joke I could tell you that could make you laugh. There is certain music you might want to hear when you go home today. Now, tomorrow, when we add some time to it, listen, you believe you walked out and tripped in that snow and, you know, that type of thing. But no, comedy, basically comedy is a disappointment with a friendly relations. Now, what I mean by that, you're a baby laying in the crib. I'm your father. So I come and I frown. Ah! And there's enough disappointment, but you can recognize that you laugh. You're a baby laying in the crib and I'm a stranger. Ah! And you know, a friend of yours come up and tickle you. And it's funny. A stranger do it in the street and it's called molesting. Okay. And I really believe that because we don't breathe enough and breathe right, that laughter kind of gets the carbon out of the system. And what I would, you know, and the reason I say this, as children, you have someone jump on you and tickle you and you just play and play. And then there comes a point when you're ready to fight. There comes a point when it don't laugh anymore. It hurts. And I assume that's all of that carbon is out. All of that poison is out. and you don't need laughter anymore. That's just in the top of my head. I've never slowed up long enough to do the research. Eventually I will, but I would like to see a group of people take deep breaths for a long time, and then go in and listen to comics and see, you know, what the laughter, you know, would be like. You know, we can recognize a laugh just by an expression. Someone else recognizes just by falling all out of their chair and all out of their seat. But I, as a social comedy, you know, in the early days of comedy, I would get fantastic mail and press with, gee, he's solving many problems with the comedy. I don't believe that. I believe a lot of people feels less uncomfortable, but it was not my intention. If, for instance, if you part of the women's movement, I would think it should insult you if I tried to get certain things pushed through for you through humor. I mean, a lot of people might feel comfortable by it, but that's not my role. Whenever I marched down the street, I was never funny. And whenever I got up on the stage, I was never marching. And you see, let's say that you and I are fighting for a band to bum. And let's say both of us are very funny comics. And we go to a nightclub, and we tell the funniest jokes in the world and don't get a laugh. I mean, we destroyed. Now we go to a band to bum rally and make the most beautiful, silly, serious speech ever made, and everybody laugh. We destroyed. Okay? And so I always look. You know, I guess you follow a comic home, and it don't work with your children. You know, they don't hear nothing funny. You're just dad. You're just mom. And if you do something funny, it's not one of your lines. It's your body. It's just, you know, relating.
But they probably also wouldn't want to have you discussing social activism with them all day at home either.
Well, but I'm saying, you know, it's something you don't do. But I'm saying as a comic, you know, we can see where you wouldn't discuss that with them all day at home. Whereas as it's very easy to believe that, you know, as a comic, you're dealing with it. And I think, first, I believe that celebrity status and God do not occupy the same body. And that's why people that can handle it perfectly is very very, very special. I look at Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis as a good example of people. But I think if you look back at the entertainment celebrity status, why you got all the fears and the frights and the hang-ups and all of the perversions and all of the drugs and all of the same is because, you know, there's a void in there, you know, that there's something in there that makes you bigger than that God force. So it just moves back out your way. And I'm just thankful that the woman I'm married to never put no demands on me, because it's been very easy for me to have gone the other way. I was born and raised in poverty, always wanted all the fine things in life and never knew if I'd get them, but I just always wanted them. I wanted everything the movie stars had, and then I got to the potential where I could get that. And luckily, like I said, the woman never had a demand on me from celebrity status. So I've been married 23 years, and I doubt at the height of my show business career, she ever been in 6 nightclubs with me. It just, that was just never, you know, her stick, and never was into it. And so consequently, I've never smoked a reefer in my life. But that's not a mark of my integrity. You see, I come out the old school where anything the white power structure said was okay. So I used to drink 5 scotch every day and smoke 4 pack cigarettes every day. So I'm sure if reefers would have been legalized and cocaine would have been legalized, I probably would have. But I just fought too long to be able to walk down the street without having something in my pocket that every time I see a cop, I got to flinch. That's why I quit speeding. I mean, I got to the point, I used to speed and every, I mean, I was on the highway once and this squad car is coming down and I pull over and wait for them. They went right past me. And it dawned on me, they weren't named after me. But the burden of wrong was on me. And I said, never again will I speed again. And that's what really reduced me to that. I just don't want to have to do anything that I'm ashamed of or got to hide or wonder if I'm going to be caught.
Well, when you're in a club now or being like tonight at the University Museum, what kinds of things do you talk about or do?
Well, one, I stopped working nightclubs in 1973 because, like at the university, I will say that drugs and alcohol is bad. I'd been saying that for a long time. I refused to do public announcements on television to you warn the children about drugs because they wouldn't kick in alcohol. You know, and I listen to preachers on Sunday. I turn on TV in the hotel and I hear them say, drug this and drug that. And yet 70% of all homicides in this country is under the influence of alcohol, but they know when they get into alcohol, they're getting into the congregation. It's very easy to pick on the children that's dealing with the drugs. So we don't even, you know, we don't even deal with that.
Would you have done it, by the way, if they put in alcohol? Would you have done one of those TV spots?
Yes, yes. Because, see, I knew something then that they know now. As long as you tell youngsters drugs, 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 and never mention alcohol, alcohol wins by default. Automatically, they think there's nothing wrong. And now, today, we're approaching 4 million alcoholic children in this country. You even have parents that the drug thing became such a a political thing that they would encourage their children to drink because as vice president of Sears and Roebuck, I could face, you know, my son getting caught with some whiskey. Boys would be boys than I could with some reefers, you know. And so it was that type of thing. And so I felt to say, come on into the nightclub and catch my eye and the atmosphere there. And many people, because I know myself, I just felt bad going to the nightclub drinking soda pop. When I felt I was wasting my money and I felt like the whole manhood sex thing was a glass. And so I just decided that I would just walk out of them. And so now I work no place that would serve alcohol.
Hmm. So, like at the University Museum tonight, do you talk or do you?
I talk. Normally I talk for about 3 or 4 hours. I'm in a show setting tonight. So I'll talk about, you know, what's going on over in Argentina.
What's your take on that?
Well, we have some generals over there that would make Hitler blush and with their behavior. And we have Britain that taught the whole world how to be corrupt with their colonialism, with their heathenism, with their craziness. And anytime two old thugs like that can go at each other, And someone with Haig's record can end up being a peacenik, then maybe God is trying to tell us it's over. And I just will just draw the the picture and just let you look at it. And I mean, we talk about Ronald Reagan, and I'll say I think, you know, a black American has overreacted to Ronald Reagan. Now, I didn't vote for either one of them. But I think as long as the American people continue to go to the polls and vote for the lesser of the two evils, then one day you should end up with the evil of the evil. That's what you really deserve. And, you know, anytime we go and vote in November, but the law tells us that legally our president is not picked until December by the electoral college, and electoral college don't have to pick the person that had the popular vote. And most folks in America don't even know who the electoral college is. And if that's how they voted in Russia, we'd say that's communism for you. And so I will tell them that I really didn't vote for Ronnie or Jimmy, but secretly I was pulling for Jimmy Carter to win because of his lips. And then I don't explain that. If you know, you know. And I'll tell black folks, don't really be too upset with Ronald Reagan, because if you write Ronald Reagan's name backwards, it spells nigger. And if you write Reagan backwards, it spells nigger. So at least we can boast we got a backward nigger in the White House. And then I look at his budget cuts. And I will explain to the audience that if you look at the budget cuts, they have a fantastic effect on white folk, but black folk have been complaining so much, white folks haven't had time to complain. But let's go back a year ago and when he cut 42% off the Coast Guard the budget. Now, you know, black folks just wouldn't know how to act in the ghetto if we couldn't wake up seeing the Coast Guard every morning. So you know that affected us. And he cut about 62% off the Federal Bureau of Dams. And all black folks in America know, all of us ever been to a dance to see a large amount of black folks leave every night at 10 o'clock to go down to the Federal Bureau of Dams. And, you know, we really know that black folks ain't never had a damn job down at the damn bureau. And then last summer when, with a stroke of a pen, Ronald Reagan raised the price of yacht fuel, and that really depressed black folks last summer. And we just sit all through the ghetto last year discussing the high price of yacht fuel. These are the type of things that I will get into. Whatever is in the paper today, I really got in a while. I was at the University of Ohio State last night, and I got to talking about how silly this trial is with Hinckley. You know, I mean, here's a guy that couldn't have sex with a woman, so he shot the president. And, you know, being a man, there's been a lot of times in my life I didn't have sex with a woman. I didn't feel like shooting the president. I mean, matter of fact, you almost come closer after you have sex with one. You shoot somebody than before. You're just so disgusted and wiped out. But then to look at psychiatrists, you know, you see, if I came to you today and I'm trained in the field of heart specialists and I tell you that your heart is really in bad shape, and then here's another guy come and he says, it's not. Well, that really kind of says something not about you, but something about our profession. and psychiatrists, basically, they've been to the same schools, read the same books, and how one team of psychiatrists can come in and say, boy, it's crazy, and another team come in and say, he's not, really kind of says something about, you know, I mean, anytime we sit here and a group of testers come in, taste testers, and one group say it's sweet, another group say it's bitter, then I get rid of the testers because something had to be wrong with them. You cannot go that far extreme with people who's supposed to be professional testers. And so what I'll do, I'll get in to everything that have happened. I'll question how when Bellucci died and we all got all this news about cocaine. All at once, they told us that the United States government made the biggest cocaine bust in the history of America. $1 billion worth of cocaine was confiscated at the Miami International Airport. And then I'll say, you know, something's wrong with that because dope smugglers don't ship drugs through international airports because you have to go through customs. And then I'll ask the question, how did they make a $1 billion drug bust, the biggest cocaine bust in the history, and never arrested nobody? I mean, that's totally impossible. And, you know, and I wonder why the press haven't asked, how do you make $1 billion? I mean, if someone shipped $1 billion worth of safety pins with that type of money involved, all you got to do is put on decoy clothes and fake like you're the janitor. Somebody going to come and pick it up. So I just think, you know, they were playing the game. I'll also talk about Afghan and how the FBI, we can sit back and let them take a criminal hoodlum thug and dress him and pose him as an Arab sheikh and start picking who they want. You see, I believe everybody, if you search their records in Afghan, knew something that was very embarrassing or could have been very embarrassing. And, you know, it was very interesting. The guy's wife, who was the Arab sheikh, she got ready to blow the whistle on him. And had she lived, you know, they claim she committed suicide that Friday in Tampa, Florida, but had she lived till that Monday to go before that grand jury, everybody in Afghan would have came out of jail. Because she was going to talk about the fraud of the FBI and her husband. Now, remember, that happened in Tampa, Florida. And then we had this big plane wreck of Air Florida on its way to Tampa that hit the bridge in Washington, D.C. And I kept looking at that plane all week on TV and said, God, I think I can snatch it out the water. How come they can't? And then the first news said that there was some very important government documents, the only copies. What they didn't tell us, there was a Justice Department official on that plane that had the only AFCAM files in existence, went down with that wreck. And had that woman lived and those files been there, Senator Williams would have probably still been in the Senate because I'm sure he was going to blow the whole thing. And so that's all I'll do. I'll just go and ask people, you know, think about Argentina, you know, 600,000 sheep and 1,800 people, and that's not what you fight a war over. But if you go back and do your homework, you find out 4 years ago, America and Russia signed a treaty over the Falkland. That's where the number one weather behavior modification research centers exists. And the next wars will be fought over who can modify the weather and who can manipulate the crops. So, you know, all I want to do is just say, ask yourself some questions and start thinking.
Have you voted since you ran for president?
No. I would really never vote for the lesser evils at all, in no shape, form, or fashion.
I know some people who don't vote in national elections who do vote in local elections because it's closer to home. And
if I can find somebody that I trust, that I like, that's just not running a game. You see, the problems will not be solved by Democrats or Republicans. The issue in America is right against wrong. It's just that clear, you know. And the person, what we need is someone, it's either a stateswoman or a statesman, to just get up and say, here's what I will present. And they might not win, but at least we have to get used to that. I mean, we have to feel it. Someone else have to have that other voice and say that, you know, that the number one national defense is not your military, it's your farmers. Because if your country can't eat, you're in trouble. 98% of all revolutions in the last 15 years have been over food. The governments have been toppled. So when our farmers in America can't get their loans in the spring and the number one farmer supply, International Harvest, on the verge of bankrupt, if you don't plant in the spring, we might not feel it, but in September when you go into the grocery stores and it's not there, there'd be a rumble. And the number two is your children and your schools. And when you cut billions of dollars off of schools, and then go to South America and say, we'll give you billions of dollars if you behave. You see, in Chicago, not too long ago, I read an article where it said $50 million was cut off the Chicago budget. But don't worry, because the governor of Illinois and the mayor of Chicago had just had a meeting, and it looked like they're going to put a special tax on alcohol to raise most of the $50 million. Anytime the most Christian nation on the planet have to educate your children predicated on how much whiskey, you know, the citizens drink, then maybe God is trying to talk to us.
Dick Gregory is my guest, if you're just joining us. You're on the 10th day of a fast in solidarity with the women who are fasting now until the ERA is either ratified or the deadline passes. Why is the ERA an important issue to you?
Well, one, it might not be that important if just black women didn't have it. But when I look around and see white women, and it wouldn't bother me maybe if it was some dude came down here from outer space. But when white women haven't got theirs, that means that's their father, that's their brother, that's their husband. That's the chump they sleeping with. Well, if they ain't going to liberate the white mother, Lord knows my mother is going to be in trouble. That's one reason. Two, nobody can really stand for liberty and justice and freedom and everything decent and not be for that. See, first, they've made so much craziness over that. They make people believe that once it's passed, women is liberated. You know, I mean, that's the biggest game in town. But, you see, I never understood the magnitude of racism until I had to understand the magnitude of my sexism. You see, it never dawned on me when I was in school, 80 to 90% of the physical education money was spent on men's PE. That, you know, if you come up in a family when I was coming up and the girl was real bright and the boy was, you know, just, it was no doubt the boy would go to med school and the girl wouldn't go to college. And so the same, for instance, we hear people say, well, America's a good country. Say, the guy, he's president of the major corporation, but he came over here, he couldn't speak the English language. He started off as a janitor, now he's president. Hey, him and my daddy started off at that same place as a janitor, and my daddy's much more brilliant than him, but my daddy's still a janitor. So white America cannot really judge their progress as long as you have a racist system, because did you make it at my expense? We men in America can never judge our progress because did we make it at women's expense? You know, how many women was not permitted to go to law school, you know? And had they been in law school, what type of laws would we have today? How many women was not permitted to go to med school? And how long ago would we have open heart surgery had they been? So, you know, the success that we men make is at the expense of women. When I sit and look at automobile commercial, and I see them use a woman as a sex symbol, then quite naturally, a five-year-old boy to see that commercial 15 years from now is 20, and when that woman get in the car, naturally he's going to put his hand on her. And I just don't know why today women, with the new strength you're getting, have not put the advertisers on alert that the next time you use us as a sex symbol, we calling for a nation and worldwide boycott of your product. Why? I'm sure if you do your research, you find out that rape in this country of women increase with television because of the commercials that show a car as an extension of my sex organ and show you as a sex symbol. That, and women like to ride in cars, but 99.9% of all cars are stolen by men. You know, why? Because it's not an extension of your sex organ. And so when you sit and you look at the thing, and, you know, somewhere I would really like to be able to look at a woman without checking out her rump and her legs and her thighs. And it's just nice to know now, thanks to that liberation movement, that I also have a right to say I don't want to dance with you. See, before, when I grew up, I didn't know that. If a woman come and ask you to dance, oh, God, man, you was But now I realize, no, I don't care to dance. I just don't want to dance. I don't want to take you to lunch, you know, that whole thing. So what's going to happen is we're going to mature and we're going to get set free. And for the first time, it's really going to be a groovy system. We're going to go through the fear. I really believe that the most violent thing that's going to happen to this planet is the women's liberation movement in America could destroy this whole planet. And let me tell you why. You see, what happens in America, other people want to do. And the black movement in America tipped off worldwide people fighting for freedom, including white folks. Okay? So when the women do it here, it's going to set up such a thing with women around the world. Most countries, that sexist thing is interwoven into religion. And you ain't seen no violence until people start challenging. You know, what happens one day when someone challenged the story of Locke? No one ever told her not to look back. Now, we assume that they did because that's the way we treat women. I mean, when Christ rolls up out the tomb, here's his mother that sees that, and when she come back and tell them 11 dudes, because one of them, they didn't believe her. You know, that whole kind of thing. You know, King James version of the Bible, King James would make Hitler look like he was decent, and yet we have his version and the passionate resentment he had for women. There's no way this man can put out a version. You know, 2,000 years from now, if we're reading Hitler's version of the Bible, it's not dangerous if we understand Hitler. So when we see all Jews in his versions was devils, you just totally got the key and know how he felt. But to read King James' version of the Bible without understanding King James. And so I just feel very close, and I think the answer to peace on this planet is going to be that woman that's liberated. That's where we're going to end war, when that woman don't have to sit back and raise her babies for a macho machine to send them to the front line. And just totally, I mean, think about, I'm your son, and the mafia slap you now. And if I get a gun and shoot them, I can be prosecuted because I didn't call the police, and it's murder, right? But I can go lay on some foreign country and shoot at somebody and take a chance of being killed, but I can't defend and protect my mother. And I just believe, you know, let's look at Argentina now. You got silly men fighting a stupid war over manhood. You have some women in Illinois that have chose a 44-day fast. They didn't come with guns and bombs and handguns. Let me tell you, if women ever get reduced to the level of violence, we're in trouble. Because all you got to do is walk sexy. And all you got to do is put them hand grenades in your brassiere. And we so busy thinking we looking at big breasts, it never dawned on us. That's the dynamite you're going to level the building down to the ground. And I just hope that, you know, we don't scar the women, that they don't have to fight so hard that, you know, it really hurts the whole thing. But, you know, somewhere women have to be liberated. Somewhere, you know, we have to stop saying to women in college, you're a fresh man, you know. I mean, I'm not a fresh woman. You know, let me tell you, when I'm a little child and I'm walking down the street and I see a stop sign that says, walk, don't walk, that's a man. I mean, that's a thought. That's a man's, a silhouette of a man telling me to walk, don't walk. Walk, don't walk. It gets that type of craziness, you know, in the head. And somewhere, I think what they're doing is probably one of the most important things that's happening now, the way they're doing it. And they're saying, we do care. And never before have a group of women, you know, ever just went, because we say fasting with a man and all that willpower and that strength. And that's what they're fixing to do, and it's just very beautiful, and it's very important. And I believe it's going to work. I believe the conscience level across this country is going to rise. The important thing about that fast is not till one of them almost died will it start getting reported and count down every day. But every time we sit down and eat, we'll have to think about those women. Someone picketed the president the other night in California that was at a $1,000 plate. Said, I dare you to eat a $1,000 plate when seven women is starving. You know, that type of thing. And I think it's going to be very beautiful. And you know, my wife, Joan, and I was, you know, I called home and my oldest daughter just came back from college. And she says, I've been fasting all week, Dad. And so it's just very beautiful. And I think those of us who really want to see this and don't want to see anything happen, we should go to God, go to prayers. You know, we the little people on this planet that believe in God and believe in prayers. And when I talk about God, I'm talking about them isms and them osms. I'm talking about that universal God force that's locked inside of you. If we tune to that, we see it pass.
Now, I want to talk with you about fasting. But before we get to that, it's been my observation that a lot of people think that the Equal Rights Amendment and women's issues in general mean different things amongst white people than it does amongst black people. And I know that there are a lot of people who feel that in the black community, feminism in the area is a very divisive issue and that it's not as important as other issues are and that it divides the men and the women and that it's therefore not something that people should be putting a lot of time into. How do you feel about that?
What bothers us is whenever white folks have a movement that creates negativity, and you might get your head cracked. Everybody wants to come get me. But whenever it's about the big jobs and going to the universities, they never reach back and get me. So we saying, what you doing is honorable. We black folks ain't blocking it. Now just go ahead. In the civil rights movement, we never slowed up our movement because a whole lot of white folks wasn't down there. And we never blamed white folks because Bull County Sheriff whooped our heads. But what would happen if some black cops jumped on some ERA women today? How many white folks, because that racism still lurks there, would say, oh, them niggas is against our thing? And we never said all white folks was against the civil rights movement because of George Wallace. You understand what I'm saying? And so I'm saying, go ahead and do your thing. You see, there's a lot of things that we black folks have done that have caused a lot of things good to happen for white America. And the civil rights movement was one, because out of that came the human rights movement. But you see, when you fight to get equal rights, there is no thing that's going to say sex discrimination laws just against white women. So my sister's going to get that pay. When Bell Telephone got to pay off for discriminating against women, you understand? And who needs that extra money any more than my black sister, who's laying at that house most of the time by herself and trying to raise that family? But all we're saying is we've been out here struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling. And the way you test how black folk feel, I'm not against you. You know, we're not up there. It was good when I went in there. And I understand when they sit down and say, well, we don't know if how much visibility we want to give you because we don't want people thinking that a man is running this and we don't want people to think that you're
telling. You mean when you went to visit the...
Yeah, and I said, hey, that's the same thing as the civil rights movement. We used to tell white folks the same thing, you know, so I can handle it. And when you make your decision, don't make it on my feelings. So they called me. See, when I got to the hotel, God, we would love to have it. I said, well, I can't stay with you because the people that's against it would make a sex thing out of it. Okay, that whole thing, you know. And so, you know, but they are similar. I mean, they said, oh, they violent, or they just, all them black folks, they just, you see, first I couldn't get a job because I'm black. Now they claim the only reason I get a job is because I'm black, okay? That's that whole thing, they're lesbians, and they want this and that. Well, you know, first, when we sit and we look at this struggle, I saw black women come down, and one black woman asked me, why was I there, you know? And then she says, God, you know, I really love you because I really thought you was going to change when I pulled you over here and challenged you. And I just said point blank, you can't be for rights. You cannot be for the human thing. And the more I would say, all the black senators and, well, you know, all the black, here's the way you look. Go and find a state legislator across the country where a black legislator voted against the ERA. Okay? All right? I don't know the percentage, but I can truthfully say that 99% more black legislation in racial proportion have voted for it than white legislators have voted for me. And so we just said, what's that hang up about? Why I need to? You see, we have white women that say a poor black woman got the same right to have an abortion as a rich white woman. Well, we resent that. Why? Because long as something's being taken from my sister, she has rights. But when we ask to give her something, we can't find it. Do she also have the same right as that rich white woman to have some luxuries, to send her child to good schools, not to have rats jumping out the baby's crib? And so this is what we say. Whenever there's a fight, people always come and get us. And when we're not there, they wonder where we are. And so, you know, you don't see that many black folks out there in the nuclear thing, but you don't see none running. When I go through the airport, them is white folks. You know what I'm saying? Them is young, white, intelligent-looking youngsters saying nuclear bombs is okay. And you have to know that it's something bigger than that because ain't none of them fat. Ain't none of them look uneducated. And you cannot be educated and not know there's something wrong with nuclear weapons. And yet, when the movement, so everybody say, well, where are they? Every time we get ready to take over a nuclear plant, they want to know where the niggas are. Hey, I mean, I've never been called to the rock concert, and nobody ever questioned where I am. But and so that's the only way I can explain that. I think, you know, that there's a suspicion in the black community and would assume that all of this is going to benefit white women, and it probably will. I mean, there's a whole lot of white. There's a lot of black women that's getting benefits because I can hire a woman and a black and a minority just by getting that one. You know, and if I could get a crippled black woman, I'd have the whole spectrum. But I think those suspicions are normal. I think, you know, the white movement is going to have to work as hard as the black movement did to say to white Americans, y'all welcome. you know, and you know, and just don't listen to that few things that you hear some folks say about honky this and honky that. And I think, you know, when you look at the history of the struggle in America, look at the unions. Okay, I belong to the same union, but it's a racist union, and I got a bad job, and I pay the same dues as the white boy. So when you look at my history of struggle, you know, we didn't ask for a bus. We asked for quality education. If black folks would say, give us a bus, we don't have the power to get a bus. And yet they give us a bus, and white folk blame us for it. You know what I'm saying? They don't have the honesty and the integrity to blame the bus companies who's made billions of dollars in the rubber industries, you know. You know, we got to fight. SCLC is marching across the country for the voters' rights bill. And yet, 2 months before they voted in El Salvador, that's all they talked about. The election, the election. How can we put an election with them thugs in El Salvador as being so important to democracy, and at the same time, I'm fighting? You know, for instance, if the Communist Party in Poland said today, any school that opens up and segregates against Solidarity's children will get a tax break, Ronald Reagan would go crazy and call on the Pope and want to send him some cheese. And yet in America, he said any school that segregates against minorities should have a tax break. That insults us. And, you know, and you have to look at my dues. I could have gone to World War II, and the same German that killed me, okay, can come to my country today and live in a neighborhood my son can't live in. That hurts. When we sit around and look at a bus drive us 50 and 60 miles sometime past hundreds of white schools to put us in a black school, and now when that same bus that was used for immoral reasons is used for moral reasons, everybody gets outraged. And all we're saying, if that bus was bad now, how come it wasn't bad then? And then also you must remember that there's certain things that white folks don't have to tell us. You see, we know the best friend white folks ever had in America is us. We built this country, and yet America goes all over the world and give people better privileges than they give us. I mean, a Cuban trying to escape communism can come over here and get on welfare, and it's very honorable. But, I mean, my mother, who's part of the family that have built this nation, think about, there was a time, and this is what blows me when a black woman takes birth control pills or wants an abortion. There was a time that a black woman found out she was pregnant in that slave tent, and she fell on her knees and prayed to her God that that baby could be born deformed. Now think about a mother praying for a deformed baby, because God, I know if I can get this baby born with a twisted body or maladjusted or limb missing, they can't sell that one. I get to keep this one all my life, you know. So when you look at, we know that if most white folks' own brother or sister or mother or father or husband or wife or niece or nephew would treat them for 3 days the way this system have treated us, they put a pistol on them white folks and blow their brains out. But we know white folks don't take stuff when you're messing with them. And yet, this system have just misused me, and we steal. And they go all over the world. They can give Russia $1 billion worth of wheat on credit, stipulated they don't have to be paid back. And then Russians said they was going to bury y'all. And yet me, who have never done nothing but behaved myself. I remember one time I realized they didn't want me to have a white woman. Okay? I got a light-complected black woman in my car, and I see a cop, and she have to hide because that racist cop might think that's a white woman. And I go, well, how long can I be insulted? How long? And then to listen to some white folks in America discuss me, you would think that we went over to Europe and grabbed white folks kicking and screaming and brought them over here on buses and kicked them and beat them and said, you will run my banks. You will become president of AT&T. And so when you look at the other side and look at my behavior pattern compared to what white America's behavior pattern would be, if their own mother put them through the same thing, then we sit back and we look. And so, you know, so we sit and we look at it from a hurt, from a suffering. And so we are suspect. We are suspicious of everything. But, you know, you've never heard the NAACP and the major leadership groups in this country come out and say the women's equal rights movement is wrong. We never said that. Now, we might not be out there because there's a whole lot of black folks that feels uncomfortable being out there. But I'm not also at the opera. I'm also not downtown. I'm also not down where the heavy stuff go down. And so consequently, the ERA could walk through the black community and could be safer walking through my community than you could walking through some hostile white communities. And I dare say, would nobody throw no brick at you? And you wouldn't have to have one black in your group. Just walk through with your signs. Okay, that's what I'm saying. That's that type of silence that we have to feel, that unity. But what you're doing, there's some young blacks that's coming up now that will reap the benefits of this. And this is one of the cleaner movements that will come across, because it will never be, you know, that sex discrimination, you know, you'll benefit from it, but I won't. That white woman might get the job if it comes to who, but that's not you. That's me also dealing with this. You see, when a woman walks in the room, and as a man, I automatically feel I have a right to glance at her, okay? Then when a black walk in the room, I have to grant that same right to white folks to glance at my blackness. Then you see how vicious it is. And how it's etched into the memories. And then all you have to do is move it. Now, I got some children coming up, and there's some black children coming up now. They ain't going to tolerate this now. I'm not talking about violence. I'm just talking about attitude, just behavior patterns. See, my mama tolerate. Think about what that black sister had to go through. That 15 years ago, I go to work. And when I get to work, he called me a coon and a boy and a nigger and goose me in my rump and pat my head. And if I hit him, I go to jail, I lose my job. So I got a wife and some children. So every evening when I come home, I've been reduced to such a level, I have to overreact my manhood. So I jumps on my wife. I don't want to hear nothing nobody say. I beats up my children. I won't hear nothing. That whole price that black woman had paid for a system that had just been vicious to me as a black man. I come home overset, because all at once I got to get it back. And when I leave home in the morning, I cannot leave with the dignity that a white father leaves with, going to make the bread and butter for the family. I'm going to be humiliated. And it almost makes the food taste like poison. You know, when I live in a country today where black folks die 10 years younger than white folks, 6 years younger than white folks, and when I think that when I sit at the dinner table with my children, I have to look 60 deaf years in the face that a white father and a white mother don't have to look in the face. And so I would say that, you know, this movement is really going to change this country. I mean, it's going to, for years, we men have been able to put our hand on a woman's thighs and very politely she would move them, you know, very politely. There's a lot of women that's quitting the police department. I did a speech at a police's convention. A lot of women have been put on the police department. It's leaving because of stress, because the guys riding in the squad cars, funneling them, playing with their breasts, you know, and hitting on them, propositioning them. And they go in and they say to the sergeant, you know, or to the captain, and they say, well, you do look kind of fine. Oh, come on, you know, come on. Oh, sergeant, oh, boys will be boys. You know, why are you so touchy and thin-skinned? Okay, so a lot of women. So I asked them, I said, what happens one day when we get the type of legislation, like now it say you can't discriminate against women? What happens when it say you can't discriminate against gays? What's your reaction going to be when a gay dude reach over in the center of your pants and touch your? You're going to pull your pistol out and blow his brains out, and you're not going to give no time. But if that woman pulled her pistol out and blew your brains out, it would be a reflex. So you see this whole madness, this whole thing, the whole challenge of what's going to happen. You know, we black folks are amused. We have a white Jesus in our house. Never complained about it. A white Jesus Christ with a beard and a robe and sandals and long hair. And when that young white boy in the 60s for the first time started looking like Jesus with the long hair and the beard and the sandal, his father said he was a faggot. You understand? And all at once there was something wrong with him. He was smoking dope. And we keep saying, wait a minute now, how for the first time have this white dude really looked like Christ? And all at once, something's wrong with him. So we sit back and we really look. And another thing we have to remember, that white folks know little about black folks, but I've been forced to know about white folks. My very survival had to make me know about. And then women, too, is also in the same bag that men is in, black folks in. See, you see, if you don't like Jews, if my nose and my name didn't give me away, you'll have to say some awful things in front of me about Jews. I can't hide mine. So a dude can see that nigga coming 2 miles away. The minute I walk, you can't hide yours, you know. But you see, now that we in the corporate structure, the nigga jokes got to cease. Now you women get in the corporate structure, those sex jokes got to cease. And what happens when the dudes go on a convention and they allot X amount of money for booze and whores? And what happens when the woman say, well, did you put something in there for my pimp? Okay, then all at once something wrong with her. How do men decide that the night before they get married, they can have a stag party and bring in all the prostitutes and perverts from a 100-mile radius, and boys will be boys? But if you wanted to bring in some pimps and some studs from Kansas City the same night, you wouldn't be fit. Now, what kind of morality is this that yours, and if I demand to hire one out of you, why don't I free you? You know, that whole type of thing that's going to get flushed out. But I think what sometimes we in the movement fail to realize is, in order to get your clothes clean when you put in the wash, there's a thing called an agitator. And if you put it in and take the agitator out, you're not going to get it clean. And there's going to come a day that a woman is going to decide that if I can't be a priest, then I don't want part of your church. And if I cannot go all the way up the ladder, then I don't want to be, you know, part of this thing at all. And we're going to see it. We're going to see it happen, because I have a woman at home with 10 children. And I know that that mother of one child is far more brilliant and more compassionate than the president of AT&T. Because the president of AT&T can get mad and wipe out a whole department, fire them all. He can get mad at his vice president, and they run those corporations with terror. Mom can't do that. Mom got to get up, comb the hairs, put the shoes on, put breakfast on, and deal with the negative things that happen, and also the hugs and the kisses. And when you look at this, when we get that type of mentality that's running corporations, and don't bend and don't change and don't get into that macho thing and get into it. And I'm looking at it. I'm seeing the high amount of women that's smoking cigarettes now. The high amount of cancer thing that's beginning to happen now. The high stress thing. And somewhere, if you can just keep that force, that strong force that you have, you know, and it'll work. You know, it'll really work.
You're just joining us. Dick Gregory is in the studio with me, and I regret to say that we're running out of time. I wanted to ask you about hunger striking and fasting. I think you hold the world's record at 70 days.
Well, I'm going 81 days. 81 days? The world's record I hold is the longest scientific fast, which was 70 days drinking nothing but water, where scientists was actually looking at it. So that's the world's record. Nobody's ever fasted that long for scientific research.
You're one of the people who have made fasts a tool for a social change. But do you think it loses its effectiveness when, because people are used to picking up their paper and seeing that you're not eating. Does it lose its effect?
Let me say this. When you fast, you have two things. You have public opinion. That's minor. It's good, but it's minor. You know, we use 10% of our brain. Nobody's ever asked what happens to the other 90. The other 90 is used to digest your food. So on the third day of not eating, that 90 gets released back to you. And when that happens, things start happening. Every religious group on this planet that have any written documents, the head of their group fasted. The bad folks have never fasted. And so, you know, the ERA women that's fasting in Illinois, the other side of that, they come there to the Illinois legislature, and they dress in aprons, you know the story, and pass out pies and cakes to the legislators and say, keep us like this. Well, think about that same place where that happened. Here's some women that's not coming to pass you out food at all. Now, what would be beautiful would see that other side who don't want it passed to say, we're going without eating right across from you. That's never happened. Okay, so then there's a thing that's there, and there's an aura. And not only are they fasting, they are praying, and they are going through some hurt. I mean, they are going through some hurt I mean, one of those sisters is so weak, she just couldn't hardly hold her head up. But they're going to make it. They're going to go through it. I don't know what condition they're going to be in. But they, you know, they really going to. And I just told them point blank, I'm not going to come here and discuss death with y'all. Because if it's death you want, go to Pentagon. They're good at death. I'm about life. And I'm saying that with God, prayers, you know, all things is possible. And you never read in all the Bibles, whichever religious persuasion, that when they wanted something, they went out and fasted and prayed. And they didn't show it to nobody. I mean, Mahatma Gandhi never fasted over 13 days. Isn't that incredible? I mean, what come out of that? And plus, it's hard to believe that he never was head of that government. Okay, I mean, when you stop and think that he never was head of the Indian government, and that's what the power of fasting. No, I think what is going to happen, a good example is the Russians 6 months ago, that said, my wife and I is not going to eat until you let my daughter go to Massachusetts. Now, think about that wedding. That was a wedding by proxy. Now, if you and I got married by proxy, you know, everybody would laugh at us. Okay, and here's some marriage by proxy that wouldn't even be recognized in this country. And yet, the power of that fast with world opinion, they had to let that girl go. And she came to America. That's the power, because it has special, special energies and special, special fast. And we'll see it. We'll see something coming out of there. That's just going to be incredible.
So you fast not only for the effect it has on other people, but for the inner effect it generates.
If those ladies was in a cave and nobody was seeing them, the same thing would happen. There's an energy, there's a power, there's a force that, you know. You see, the sun comes out every morning and smack nighttime, clean out the sky, and never make a sound. That's power. And the sun don't care. The sun don't demand that you be up to see it. That's power. And I think what we're going to see, sure, it works better when you get a lot of press. I'm sure if I went to the White House and said that, you know, black folks should be happy, this is the greatest country in the world, and sit and fast it for 40 days to say thanks to Ronald Reagan, it'd be the biggest press thing going. When you deal with fasting and God, you can bypass the networks. Okay, there's a feed-in bigger than them, that when that feed-in hook, they can't keep you off of it.
I want to thank you very much
thank
for talking
you.
With us today. Dick Gregory has been my guest.